Thank you for downloading the East Haven Podcast. For more information about our church, please visit easthavenchurch.org. Now, please join Pastor Kevin Reiser as he brings us this week's message.
The sermon entitled, Easter's Over, Now What? And I think it's a valid question. Irony of ironies, that conversation has come up more than once this week. Okay, Easter's over, now what? We go through all the hype, we go through all the pomp, we go through all the circumstances, we go through all the shopping, and then Easter comes and we go to church, and then after we go to church, we go home, we have our ham, or whatever we have. You have to have deviled eggs, right? I always have to have deviled eggs on Easter, so I boiled two eggs and I ate those two eggs because that's what you do on Easter, right? Well, Easter's over, now what? As that question was posed to me again this week, I said, well, I don't know, because I was kind of feeling the same, you know, the big hype, we added the extra service, blah, 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 now what? And so I went back to the text, which is always a good thing to do, right? And I looked at what the disciples did after Easter was over. And you're going to be shocked to discover that after Easter was over, the disciples went back to being disciples. They went back to being disciples. Now, there was a lag time there from Easter until the ascension, when Jesus went back up into heaven. There was a 40-day period where he came in and he did some final teaching, and see, he tied up some loose ends. One of the big loose ends was that of restoring Peter to the ministry, because, you know, Peter denied him three times before Jesus was crucified. And so there was that whole thing that had to take place. But basically, after the ascension, after Easter was over, the disciples typically just went back to being disciples. They went back with a new vigor. They went back with a new passion. And at Pentecost, when you read Acts chapter 1 and chapter 2, when the Holy Spirit comes, things were good for the disciples. There was an energy there. There was a renewing there. But they were renewed in their purpose. They were still disciples, but they were renewed in their purpose. Now, there are some things that Jesus teaches us that we, if we're going to call ourselves disciples, have to come to grips with. One of those things is in Matthew chapter 6. And in Matthew chapter 6, Jesus is kind of in the middle of what we know as the Sermon on the Mount. Now, the Sermon on the Mount is where Jesus is launching his ministry. It's where Jesus is getting ready to begin his public discourse. And true to Jesus' character, he does not want to leave you and me without answers. And so the entire Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, Matthew chapter 6, Matthew chapter 7, the entire Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is basically saying, if you are going to be my disciples, these are the expectations that I have of you. I'm not hiding anything from you. I don't want you to be blind going into this thing. If you're going to be my disciples, listen to the sermon that I'm fixing to preach, and I'm going to tell you what I expect if you're going to be one of my disciples. And in Matthew chapter 6, verse 5, 6, and 7, he says this. He says, and when you pray, don't be like so-and-so, but go into your closet and talk to your Heavenly Father. Now, that's interesting because he's laying out the framework. If you're going to be my disciples, one of my expectations for you is that you are a prayer. Not a prayer, but a prayer. A person who prays. And so let's just settle the groundwork this morning. Easter's over. Now what? If you're going to go back to being a disciple, one of the first steps in being a disciple is being a prayer. And I know what you're thinking. Kev, you don't know me. I'm a sinner and I disappoint God and I fall so short. And I'm like, yeah, quit your whining already. Join the club. So am I. Anybody sinned since Easter besides me? The chairman of my deacons back here, first one to raise his hand. All of the staff members should have raised theirs. If they didn't, they just lied to you. And so if the pastor and the chairman of the deacons and all of the staff raises their hand because we've sinned since Easter, so have you. Guess what? You're in really, really, really good company this morning. But here was what my quiet time was Friday. My quiet time was out of Matthew chapter 18. I have good news for all of you sinners in the room. The good news is in Matthew chapter 18. Jesus is teaching on the subject of forgiveness. And he says, well, suppose somebody comes to us and asks us for forgiveness, and then they mess up again and they come back. And Jesus goes, I got this covered. If somebody sins against you, If somebody sins against you and they come back and they ask for forgiveness and they repent, then you forgive them. All right, I can do that. Oh, but Jesus ups the ante. He says, if somebody sins against you and they come back seven times in the same day, repentant and ask for forgiveness, guess what? You forgive them all seven times. Now we sit here and go, uh-uh. No, burn me once, shame on you. Burn me twice, shame on me. You get one chance. If you mess up, boom, that's it, you're done. That's not what Jesus says. Jesus says, you as human beings, if somebody does something to offend you and they realize that and they come back and they go, oh, I'm sorry, forgive me. Jesus said, if you're my disciples, you forgive them. Now here's my question to those of us sinners in the room. If that's how Jesus expects us to forgive as human beings, how much more so then will He forgive as our saving Lord? At some point, we have to stop and get rid of the excuse, I just don't measure up, I'm weak. He expects us to forgive if somebody keeps coming back to us and asking for forgiveness. Don't you think He's much better at it than we ever will be? And if He is much better at it than we ever will be, not only are you to be a person who prays, but you are to be a person who continually seeks His forgiveness. And if you find yourself continually seeking His forgiveness, you are forgiven. Read the book, people. Read the book. So a disciple is a prayer, and a disciple can trust in the fact that they are forgiven, making them worthy to be a disciple. Raise your hand. I'm not kidding. Raise your hand. Repeat after me. I am worthy to be a disciple. Really? With vigor. I am worthy to be a disciple. Thank you very much. You are worthy to be a disciple. Sinner though you be, mistake maker though you be. And if you have to go to Him seven times a day confessing that you have messed up seven times in the exact same way, if you do so with a contrite heart, you are forgiven. I know we don't want to believe that, but it's true. So if we are disciples, and if one of the first things disciples has to do is be prayers, it's probably good for us to learn how or what things we should pray. Would you agree? Well, in Luke chapter 14, there's a story in Luke chapter 14 about what it's like to be a disciple. There are some things that Jesus lays out as disciple expectations. I think we can extrapolate at least five things that as disciples we should pray or could pray. Let's put it that way. So I don't want you to think this is about works. Because if you pray these things and you don't have a relationship with Jesus Christ, I don't care if you pray until you pass out. It's not going to do you any good. Because you can't get there by works. You can only get there by His grace. And I've worded these prayers this way. The first thing that Luke chapter 14 talks about is he talks about loving Him above all other things. In Luke chapter 14, beginning in verse 25, the Bible says, large crowds were traveling with Jesus. And turning to them, He said, if anyone comes to Me and does not hate his father and his mother and their spouse and their children or their brothers and their sisters, yes, if you don't even hate yourself, you cannot be My disciple. Now, you sit there this morning and you go, well, Jesus shouldn't teach hate. That's just bad. And Jesus isn't teaching hate. And Jesus isn't telling you it's okay to be at odds with your mother and father or your sister and brother. This was National Siblings Week, apparently. And I felt really bad because my sister and I don't have a picture with each other. So I couldn't participate. I couldn't play along on Facebook this week. And I thought, maybe it's because we just never have liked each other. We don't have our picture taken again. And that's not true. Now that we're both over the age of 40, we've grown up some and have decided that we can be in the same room with each other. But that's not what Jesus is talking about. Jesus is saying in this passage in Luke, you should love Me so much that the love you have for your parents should look like hate. You should love Me so much that the love that you have for your children or your grandchildren should look like hate. You should be so in love with Me that the love that you have for Me compared to anything else in this world should look like hate. It's not the first time He says this. It's not the only time He says this. In Matthew chapter 10, and I really had to park on this and look at it and look at it and go back and see if it was saying what I think it was saying. Matthew chapter 10, verse 37. I'm just the messenger. Don't shoot me. Jesus says in Matthew 10, 37, if you love your father or mother more than you love Me, you are not worthy of being Mine. If you love your son or daughter more than you love me, you are not worthy of being mine. I love my kids. When I dropped Seth off at Texas Tech, I cried all the way to Dallas, 600 miles. Yesterday, my daughter's drumline from Clearbrook High School competed in the national championship in Dayton, Ohio. They sent me texts. They sent me pictures via text, but I wasn't there. I wasn't there to celebrate the excitement that they were feeling when they were crowned the second best drumline in the nation in their division. I wasn't there when the medals were passed out. I wasn't there when they were awarded the trophy, and because she's a junior and one of the leaders was on the crew that was called upon to receive the trophy, I wasn't there to celebrate that with her. And so being the sad softy that I am, being that I love her so much, I was emotional. I spent yesterday with a little tear in my eye a couple times yesterday because I'm crazy about my kids. And I watch and I look, and we live in a world where kids rule our homes. And we think we're so awesome and we're such great Christ followers because we love our children so much. Do anything in the world for them. Jesus says in Matthew chapter 10 that if you love your son or daughter more than you love me, you are not worthy to be my disciple. I had to do some hard soul searching this week about that verse. I came across a story from a young lady named Heather Mercer. Her and her friend Diane Curry were Baylor students, and they left Baylor, and they went to Afghanistan to minister to some of the poor children and some of the refugee children as a result of the war and the continued conflict and the Taliban and those kind of things in that country. And Dateline decided they were going to do a story on Heather Mercer and on her friend. But one of the things, if you saw the interview, Dateline was most interested in was the conflict that Heather had with her mom. Heather's mom was like, "We think this is stupid. You're putting your life in jeopardy for what? For a bunch of godless people who don't care about Jesus and who are never going to care about Jesus. They've never cared about Jesus. Why would you go put yourself in danger?" Then they were taken prisoner and held captive for 128 days. The mom was like, "See, I told you that was going to happen." And so when they did the interview, they were all very much interested in keeping the conflict stirred up between Heather and her mom. Well, the interview to me wasn't very powerful, but I found some quotes from her book. After she got back home, kind of got things resituated, she wrote a book entitled Prisoners of Hope. And she talked about the conflict within her own family about her going to minister in the name of Christ. She said, "We answered hard questions posed by our family and friends. Extraordinary are the parents who don't balk at the idea of their children moving to a third world, war-ravaged, drought-stricken country, and in this case, a country serving as a hub for international terrorist activity. We had decided to go as Christian aid workers to a country where a harsh, unpredictable regime severely curtailed religious freedom, gave most of our loved ones pause at best, and otherwise prompted serious alarm. We were asked, 'Aren't you being foolish? Why would you jeopardize your own life and even your own safety and even your own life?' The truth was, we went because we knew Jesus was leading us to go. We went because we knew Jesus was leading us to go." And when I read that quote, the question once again came to my mind, what would my life look like? What would my life look like if I were totally committed to hearing and doing everything Jesus guided me to do every day? What would my life look like? And then I asked the question for you, what would your life look like if you were guided by hearing Jesus' voice and doing and going every place He asked you to go and doing everything He asked you to do? Those of us who are familiar with the Old Testament story, Abraham understood this concept. When God the Father went to Abraham and said, "I want you to sacrifice your son of promise on the altar as a sacrifice to me," Abraham did it. I dare say none of us are there. I dare say we're not there. So what kind of prayer do we as disciples pray? Well, I think we would pray, "Dear Jesus, by your grace, guide me to love you supremely. Dear Jesus, guide me to love you supremely." Another question I had to wrestle with, and will continue to do so, I'm afraid, is who in my life is more important than Jesus? Or what in my life is more important than Jesus? I imagine if we're honest and start making a list, that list could get pretty long pretty quick. Easter's over, now what? Go back to being a disciple. Disciples prayed, and Jesus says one of the things that disciples do is that disciples love me supremely. That is the cost of discipleship. Secondly, in Luke chapter 14, verse 27, Jesus says, "And anyone who does not carry his cross and follow me cannot be my disciple." Carry his cross. What does that mean? Carry his cross. What? I know. I have chronic back pain. I am carrying my cross for Jesus. It's not what this passage means. This passage is perverted and polluted time and time and time again. You see, we think that anytime something inconvenient comes along in our life, we think that anytime something bad happens in our life, well, this just must be my cross to bear. No, that is wrong and rotten theology. That's called life. That's called life. Let me read this to you. Bearing one's cross is not enduring some inconvenience or infirmity, no matter how severe. No matter how bad the disease, no matter how bad the body hurts, no matter how bad the finances look, no matter how bad the marriage is, no matter how wayward the children are, that is not the cross that you bear. That is simply life unfolding before you. Bearing one's cross is an act of will. It is a choice to answer the call to servanthood. It is a choice to answer the call to sacrifice, and it may be a choice to answer the call to suffering. Bearing the cross is a call to servanthood. Mission 40 is taking up the cross. Consistently, faithfully, even when the body is screaming, "Oh, I hurt," performing a ministerial task is taking up the cross. Serving others when your bones are weary and your mind is tired is taking up the cross. Giving of your resources is taking up the cross. Giving of your time to the cause of Christ is taking up the cross. Jesus says, if you're not willing to pick these things up, if you're not willing as my disciples to adopt the posture of servanthood and sacrifice, you're not my disciples. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, in his short life, wrote volumes about these subjects. Bonhoeffer said, "The cross is not the terrible end to an otherwise God-fearing and happy life, but taking up the cross meets us at the beginning of our communion with Christ." Bonhoeffer says that we know Jesus more intimately, we know Jesus more fully, we commune with Him better when we choose to pick up the cross, when we choose servanthood, when we choose sacrifice, and sometimes, like Heather Mercer, when we choose suffering. It's not the road I want to walk, be honest with you. But there's a prayer I can pray to help me get there. The second prayer I think we can pray from Luke 14 is, "Dear Jesus, by your grace, strengthen me to choose sacrifice." Strengthen me to choose sacrifice. That is the definition of taking up the cross. There's a third prayer we can pray. The third prayer we can pray would read something like this, or go something like this. "Dear Jesus, by your grace, provide wisdom to finish well." Dear Jesus, provide wisdom to finish well. In verse 28 of chapter 14 of Luke, he says, "Don't begin until you count the cost." Again, this whole passage is about being a disciple. He says, "Don't begin until you count the cost. For who would begin construction of a building without first calculating the cost to see if there's enough money to finish it? Otherwise, you might complete only the foundation before running out of money. Then everyone will laugh at you, and they will say, 'There's a person who started that building and couldn't afford to finish it. What a loser.'" Count the cost. In your prayer time as a disciple, "Dear Jesus, by your grace, provide wisdom to finish well." Look around this morning. Look around last Sunday. Last Sunday, our official headcount was 319. It's pretty good for us. We're typically right at the 200 mark. But it's tragic when you consider that there are 1,100 members' names on the roll to this church. 1,100. Almost 700 of those we can't find. We have names, but no address, no phone number, no way of contacting them. They're certainly not here. And of those who are connected to East Haven, by connected I mean people that show up once a month, if everybody that showed up once a month would be here every Sunday, we'd have 319 every single week, not guests included. I realize discipleship is not about church attendance. But church attendance speaks to your sacrifice and your servanthood. And a disciple is faithful for the assembling of the saints. There are so many of our people that aren't going to finish well. There are so many of our people that have already stopped running the race. And that's just this church. And the tragic part of it is that we're not different from every other church. There's an equal number of people on the roll at Cokesbury and at Mount Olive and at Sagemont and at Grace. Thousands of people are still at home, snug as a bug in a rug this morning, because they have made a conscious choice to not be a disciple. They've made a conscious choice to say, I'm not going to finish well. Well, they don't put it in those words. They say other spiritual things like, well, I have church within, or I worship on the golf course. And the golf courses are pretty amazing. Have you seen pictures from Augusta this week? Man, all the rain we've had. Somebody this morning described Augusta as, that's what heaven's going to be like. I'd be okay if heaven was a golf course. That'd be pretty fun. Maybe I'd have a better game. But a disciple wakes up every morning deciding, if today is my last day, I'm going to finish well. I'm going to count the cost. This group does not recognize the name Billy Sunday, but Billy Sunday was a great evangelical preacher from the 19th century. And one of the things most people don't know about Billy Sunday is that before he was a great preacher, he was a professional baseball player. And he makes this great statement about being the kind of disciple that finishes well. Billy Sunday once said, stopping at third adds no more to the score than striking out. That's a great truth. That's a great spiritual truth. Stopping at third adds no more to the score at striking out. It doesn't matter how well you start if you fail to finish, and a real disciple will finish strong. A real disciple will finish strong. To have the attitude of, oh, I've done that before. Oh, it's time for somebody else to take over. Oh, my kids have outgrown that phase of life, so I'm just going to quit. Boy, it's not a discipleship mentality. Easter's over, so what? Get back to being a disciple. But you have to get back to being a disciple with renewed vigor and with new passion, but with the same purpose. A disciple prays for the strength to stay in the fight. A disciple prays for the vitality and the vigor to finish well. You don't get a retirement plan in the kingdom of God. What? I don't get a retirement plan? No, afraid not. Philippians chapter 1, be confident of this, that Christ, who has begun a good work in you, will carry it on to completion until the day of Christ himself. Guess what? The day of Christ comes when you die or he returns. But until then, our responsibility is to be a disciple. Our responsibility is to take up the cross. Our responsibility is to stay the course and keep up the work. There's a fourth prayer that comes out of Luke chapter 14. And we could probably pray it this way. Dear Jesus, by your grace, teach me humility. By your grace, teach me humility. I really struggle with this one. Can I be honest? I really struggle with all of these. But I don't like being humble. It makes me think I'm weak. I can't be weak. I'm the preacher. The story continues to unfold, and Jesus says there's two kings, and these kings are fixing to go to war. And one of them has 10,000 troops, and one of them has 20,000 troops. And the guy that has 10,000 troops knows that he's fixing to get his head handed to him. And so he sits down, and he counts the cost, and he's like, my army's going to be destroyed, my kingdom's probably going to crumble, and I'm probably not going to get to be king anymore. Therefore, I'm going to negotiate a treaty of peace. Now I'm fixing to get your attention. Tonight, Game of Thrones returns to HBO. Please hold your applause. If you've read the book or if you've watched any of the series, you understand and you know there are no humble kings in the Game of Thrones. It's all posturing, it's all backbiting, it's all manipulating, it's all coercion, it's all backstabbing. It's all just regular old humanity, right? And I have no idea what season 5 is going to be like, but I have no reason to believe that it's going to be different than any of the previous seasons or any of the other previous books. But it's going to be more of the same. Because the Game of Thrones, if it was all about somebody being humble and somebody being subservient and somebody making a sacrifice and somebody being a disciple, would not be a hit if that were the case. And Jesus is okay with not being a hit. Jesus is okay with counting the cost and recognizing that sometimes we have to humble ourselves for the greater good. And praying for humility is not one of our strong suits. But Jesus says this is the mark of a disciple. When I met Debbie, she was a lifeguard certified. She kept her lifeguard certification for several years after that. One of the things that they teach in lifeguarding school is that if you have a grown-up, not so much with children, but if you have a grown-up that is flailing away and is in panic mode and is thinking they're fixing to drown, you keep your distance as a lifeguard. You don't go out there and immediately get involved in their slapping in the water and their... Because if you do, they will hurt you and drag you down with them. And so lifeguards are taught to just watch. And as soon as exhaustion takes over, and as soon as the person that's swimming goes down for the last time, then the lifeguard goes in and provides rescue. Because if you don't, you could drown too. My next door neighbor used to work at the dive tanks at NASA, and he talked about these types of panic situations. And he said, as long as the divers or the one in struggle is trying to save himself, there's nothing I can do to save him. But as soon as the diver gets tired, as soon as the diver gives up, as soon as the diver relaxes in his suit, then I can provide the rescue that they need. So even at NASA, they teach exactly the same thing. As disciples, as soon as you and I decide to humble ourselves and stop fighting against God and stop challenging Him at every turn and stop thinking that He really must not be talking to us the way we think He's talking to us, as soon as we humble ourselves in His presence, as soon as we give up, yield ourselves to Him in His presence, He's free to rescue us. That's true not only from sin, but also from the other struggles that we have in this life. And a great prayer might simply be, Jesus, by your grace, help me with this issue of humility. Finally, the story tells us in 1434 and 35 that salt is good. But if it loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is neither fit for the soil, nor is it fit for the manure pile. Jesus' words, not mine, but it is thrown out. Let those who have ears, let them hear. Now, I have to explain the word salty, because salty is taking on a different definition today than it meant back when Jesus was talking about it. My children refer to me as salty when I am in a bad mood. That's just the new connotation of the word. When Debbie wants the house clean and she's like, okay, come on, everybody, it's time to clean up. I've wasted enough time with your laziness. Let's go. Crack, jump, go, move it. Ooh, mama's salty. Sometimes when they know we're mad enough that we're going to spank their honeys, and yes, I still threaten to spank their honeys, even though Seth is 6'3". Of course, he's 600 miles away, so I can threaten him all I want at this point. But when he's home, and mama and I got things we want to do, and we're trying to get the children to obey and get them to jump too, they won't say anything disrespectful, but we'll see them at the corner of our eye going. And what they're meaning is, ooh, mom and dad be salty. Right? That's not what salty means. Salty is a good word. Salty is a word that Jesus uses because he knew the people of his day would understand it. Sometimes people were paid with salt rations back then. It was such a vital part of the economy. Let me read you this. Since they didn't have any way to refrigerate meat, salt would be applied to fresh meat to prevent the meat from rotting. The salt created a chemical reaction that slowed down the process of decay. It retarded corruption. So as a consequence, it preserved the goodness of the meat. That's why Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, you are the salt of the earth. Do you understand that when you and I go out and represent Christ, when you and I go out as His disciples and have a godly influence? I think that's a prayer that you need to pray. Dear Jesus, by your grace, let me have a godly influence. When you and I go out into this world and we have a godly influence, we help prevent decay in our world. We help the rot that is going on around us to not happen. We act as a preservative for that which is good and moral and decent. That's what a disciple is supposed to do. And sometimes in order to do that, it requires sacrifice. It requires taking up that cross. Like salt, we must come in contact with our culture to slow down the process of decay. As salt, our job is to preserve the goodness that still exists. Jesus said, when you pray, because as a disciple, that's what you should do. You should pray from a posture of knowing that you are forgiven. Not perfect, but forgiven. Luke chapter 14 says, these are some of the things disciples do. And from that, these are some of the ways that we can pray. Jesus is good enough to us to allow us to be his disciples. Easter's over. Now what? If you are a born-again follower of Jesus Christ, if you have asked him into your heart to forgive you of your sin, and if you have made that confession with your mouth, then you are his disciple. So Easter's over. Go back to being a disciple. But be a better disciple than you were last year. And maybe by praying through some of these things, it will help you be a better disciple than you were last year. Next year after Easter, we'll ask the same question again. Easter's over. Now what? Go back to being a disciple. You can do it. If you couldn't do it, Jesus wouldn't have left the world in our hands after he left. You can do it. He believes in you that much.
Thank you for joining us. If you'd like to speak with someone about how you can apply this week's message to your life, please call the church office at 281-922-5520. You can find more information about East Haven by visiting easthavenchurch.org. Remember as you go to live as God's people, telling God's story, building God's kingdom.